Well, we counted the costs of one of the severest lockdowns anywhere on earth this week. It's the cost, too, of corruption and mismanagement of the economy. And it can be counted in South Africa's GDP decline of 7% for the year. It can be counted in the student protests for free education when the cupboard is bare. It can be counted in the brutal police response and the way this tragedy has been seized upon opportunistically by the Secretary General of the ruling party facing a corruption trial. It can be counted in the fact that GDP per capita has been declining since 2014, way before COVID. Our vaccine rollout barometer shows that the first target of inoculating 1.5 million people by the end of March is already going to be missed, as there is insufficient supply of vaccine thanks to government, while the country is only managing to vaccinate around 10,000 people a day. Put another way, at this rate, it's going to take us 10 years to achieve population immunity. As globally, markets put their inflation and bond yield concerns to one side, high on large injections of freshly cooked stimulus into the aorta of the world's largest economy and fresh injections of COVID-19 vaccines. To review the week that was, I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Warwick, the big story in financial markets this week is the stimulus bill, US President Joe Biden signing that $1.9 trillion bill into law overnight. And as a retreat in bond yields has eased, global concerns about rising inflation seem to go into the background. It's risk on again. Yet the number of Americans filing new claims for jobless benefits dropped to a four-month low last week, as we see this improving public health environment allowing more segments of the world's largest economy to reopen. And that certainly puts the labor market recovery back on track. So why do we need the stimulus in the US? What could go wrong?
Right, Michael. I think one of the big concerns is, of course, how is employment and unemployment data reported? I think that the Fed acknowledges that there's a lot of potential slack in the whole of the unemployment numbers. I mean, after all, one of the distinctions that gets made is between discouraged job seekers and active job seekers, as a way of example. So that has to be chucked into the whole description of whether or not there's slack in the labor market. I think the second thing is, you know, bearing in mind that there's been a heck of a lot of job destruction, the recovery in employment is not necessarily recovery in permanent employment. And I think it's we need to get some clarity as to just what kind of quality of job is coming through there. So I think there's a fair bit of water to flow under the bridge there before both the Feds and government decide, well, they're going to take the foot off the monetary and or fiscal accelerator.
And for markets, the big question, I guess, is what are American consumers going to be spending their money on? Is it going to be more Robin Hood type retail traders looking for severely shorted obscure stocks on the S&P 500?
Michael, I think it's going to be a kind of a bifurcation. I think for those who are in desperate straits and have been out of job for a long time, I think it will be not nearly enough. And for those that don't need it, it's off to the Robin Hood accounts. So I think it'll be a massive sort of barbell effect across the, shall we say, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where, some of it gets gambled and some of it gets spent on absolute basics. I mean, the reality is that it's been a general sort of showering of money that's not really been particularly well means tested, either the last one or the current one. I don't think anything's really changed there.
Yeah, and that is why there is this concern around it certainly spurring inflation on. Raymond, to bring it into the local markets here, what impact, if any, do you see this massive stimulus in the US having on our market? It doesn't seem, from where I'm sitting, like there's too much for South Africa to gain from this. So we did see that our current account was positive in the last year, so we're exporting more than we're importing. Do you see this in any way stimulating South African exports?
Hi, Michael. Look, I think what's good for the American economy, you could probably say at this stage, is good for most of the emerging economies like South Africa, bearing in mind also that the United States is our second biggest trading partner. So obviously what happens there is of interest to us. I think it's just reassurance, perhaps, nothing dramatic, but as we've seen, and we'll talk about it later when we talk about the GDP figures, the world economy has come to our rescue in the past few months. It's very, very supportive with the commodity prices and so forth. So I think we'll see what is happening in the United States at the moment as the most important priority is to ensure growth in the American economy, and in that way, hopefully, be supportive of the world economy, and in that way also, to some extent, be supportive of emerging economies. So I think, on balance, we should welcome this. Yes, there are risks, but I think at the moment, let's worry about what has to be worried about now, and that is to get growth and employment going in the biggest economy in the world, and then we must take it from there.
And Warwick, if we look at it, if you've got the world's largest consumer economy consuming more, then you're going to have to be producing more, and that's what China certainly does very well in some of the surrounding countries now, and that's good for commodities. So in that roundabout way, it is once again supportive of this commodity bull run that we've seen kick off the year.
It certainly has, Michael. I mean, between the two of them, namely consumer spending generally and stimulus by governments because of the need to restart economies, it certainly has been a very positive win for the commodity sector ships. And they are not over-invested in capacity at all. I think a lot of them in most of the early 2000s really did not overdo it. They got into a little bit of trouble, I think, at the tail end after they weren't put off by the 2008 crash. But I think that capacity has been thoroughly used up by now. And I think we've got a favorable structural environment for commodity producers. Of course, the massive consumer boom in terms of demographics from China is not going to be anything like it could have been in the past. But nevertheless, it is a very positive headwind. And I guess the next is really looking for the kind of next 10 economies, as it were, those other big Southeast Asian economies to come through and help drive the ship along.
And that all feeds into that GDP print, Raymond, that we saw for the fourth quarter. It did surprise on the upside, and the surprises do look pretty broad-based if you go through the numbers. What do they tell us about South Africa's performance over 2020?
Well, Michael, I think the headline figure is the -7%. We mustn't lose sight of that, even though underneath that there were some better numbers towards the end of the year. And I think it was more or less what most of us were expecting, give or take one or two decimal points. But I just want to emphasize at the outset that when we unpack these numbers, we can't just be clinical. We must bear in mind that a year ago we were in recession. We came out of a 2019, which had a 0.2% growth, and a 2018, which had a 0.8%. Now, I think there are three or four things when you look into the rear vision mirror of last year. Firstly, let's not underestimate the extent to which the -7% represents an economy which was devastated. There's no doubt about it, and we're still coping with that legacy. There was widespread business failure, some of it permanent. There was rising unemployment, which still has to be regained, and there were income losses. So what we saw last year, and what the numbers, the overall number is telling us, is that the fault lines of unemployment, poverty, and inequality were simply aggravated last year. Then we saw the second important point is, nonetheless, as I mentioned earlier, the world economy has come to be supportive, that commodity prices have been positive, our agricultural sector has been positive, and so has mining. So that's helped to make some of the numbers towards the end of the year look a little better. The third point is, it just emphasizes again, when one reflects on last year, the direct relationship between economic and business activity on the one hand, and the lockdown exit strategy on the other. It was like a tap being turned on and off as we move through that phase. And I think it may be that we live in an imperfect economy, that the private enterprise system has its faults, but we showed yesterday when we got those numbers for the GDP last year, what happens to the economy when you shut down those controversial market forces, and they're not there to give you the jobs, to give you the growth, and to give you the investment you want. Then the final point was that nonetheless, the year ended on a more positive note, that there is a foundation for a rebound, which I think we must talk about. So I think those three or four of the parameters shape my reaction to the numbers of 2020.
A very Ayn Randian comparison there, Warwick, to what happens when you chase those dirty capitalists away. Well, growth dries up, jobs dry up, and prosperity tends to flee along with them. What did you make of, in the rearview mirror, what was revealed in that GDP print this week?
I think what's really not gone through in many minds that need to appreciate it is just how fragile business often is. Despite appearances of being robust, running dog, bullying capitalists, in reality, many of them are basically cash flow, kind of almost perpetual motion machines. You've got to have cash flow coming in and cash flow going out, and it circles around a heck of a lot to keep the wheel turning. I mean, we only have to look at the likes, for example, of the business travel hotel market. I mean, many of those businesses are permanently destroyed. Permanently. I think quite a few either converted to rental, but many others simply shut down and put into liquidation as a good example. Look, I mean, that was a sector that was always going to be under some kind of pressure from technology. But under a normal environment, we would have thought, say, 10 or 20 years that you would sort of get some kind of shutdown. Whereas I think a switch has been thrown and it's simply been permanently smashed. I don't think that there's any kind of real recovery coming there, normal or otherwise. But it's true for a lot of businesses, and particularly services type businesses. They are actually very, very fragile. And you interfere with them at your peril. They're big employers, but they're easily destroyed by heavy-handedness.
The GDP print, obviously, the big talking point locally, and a once-in-a-century type crash in gross domestic product of 7% decline certainly shows you how difficult it was last year. But there were some glimmers of hope in that fourth quarter print. And what can we glean from that, Raymond? Because if you look at the on the production side, there were significant increases recorded in 8 of the 10 subsectors. And it did surprise many of the economists on the upside for the right reasons.
Yes, I think that was better economic news, and it does lay some foundations for a rebound, and I emphasize, as others have done, a rebound in the economy this year. It's inevitable we'll have a rebound, and I think that the foundations were laid towards the end of last year to indicate that perhaps we could upgrade our forecasts for this year, say from 3 to 3.5 or even 4%. But the RMB Business Confidence Survey this week emphasizes what Warwick has said, that yes, last year was fragile, but this recovery is also fragile and does rest on fragile foundations, because the pace of economic recovery will be shaped by a number of things this year which are still unknowns. There's firstly the possibility of a third wave of the pandemic and further lockdowns maybe. There's the security of energy supply. We're in a lockdown mode as far as Eskom is concerned with the load shedding that's on now, with further intimations of further load shedding. And then there's going to be a lag in employment. The growth figures may look better. It'll take a lot longer for the employment figures to improve and recover. So I want to emphasize that as we give one or two cheers for the better numbers at the end of last year, we must not forget our Achilles heel. if we want sustained growth beyond this year, that is why I've said we've got to capitalize on this recovery to turn it into sustained economic growth, to sustained job-rich economic growth. And when you look at the investment numbers, they're still very vulnerable. I know quite a few of the analysts have seized on the fact that in the last quarter of last year, that investment, that the total investment rose by something like 12%. I just want to caution, all that tells you, if you go back to the numbers over the past couple of years, is that the rate of decline in total investment has slowed. That's what it's telling you. So I think the important point for us now to have a look at is, what do we need to do to boost investment on the back of the better economic news that appears to be emerging for this year? Mm. And here I would like to emphasize once again, if we're looking for a roadmap of some kind, in the National Development Plan of 2012, we indicated that by 2030, if we wanted a 5 to 6% growth rate, we would have to increase our total investment, that means the government and the private sector, to about 30% of GDP. That may be a very unrealistic target, but it gives you a sense of proportion. We are now at 17%, and the numbers tell you that as a proportion of GDP, it's been steadily declining over the past 10 years or so. So here I'm saying that is why it is correct that the president talks and motivates at the investment conferences. It is right that the budget put emphasis on growth, on corporate tax, and made some right noises about wanting to mobilize the private sector. Because at the end of the day, if you want to translate the better short-term news of a rebound in this economy into sustained job-rich growth over time, you're going to have to reduce policy uncertainty, come forward and implement what is already in the pipeline in a more visible and dramatic way. In other words, if you want to improve the investment ratio, we've got to understand we're all in for the long haul, which starts now.
Well, right now we've got delays, interminable delays around spectrum auction because of Telkom's legal action, and that's frustrating that particular process. We've got delays in energy reform because of ideology, it appears, at ministerial level. What is Minister Gwede Mantashe up to? Warwick, those signs are not great. And I want to pick up on what Raymond said about the labour market, because we did see a better than expected outcome in the fourth quarter, yet the quarterly labour force survey shows that we reached record levels of unemployment in the fourth quarter. So that better than expected headline economic number is still masking deep underlying concerns about any form of job-rich recovery.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's clearly a lot to be done. I mean, in terms of the lawsuits, I can't really blame the participants who are climbing in. I mean, MTN has also climbed in there as far as lawsuits go. And the chances are it's because some bureaucrat got a bright idea and needed sorting out. And frankly, that's how things go. So you can be sure that whatever happened there is a two-way street. So I'm not blaming the participants who got messed around by some bureaucrat. I mean, yeah. As far as what's going on in the rest of the economy, well, I mean, there's all sorts of dislocations. I mean, you've seen that, for example, that we had the first current account surplus in absolute ages. But then again, our economy isn't exactly the same structurally as it used to be. For example, one of the features of the South African economy in the past were massive inflows of retail buyers from the rest of Africa, who would either fly in or drive in, buy our retail goods and leave. Now, of course, then that left a permanent hole in the bookkeeping. So you must remember with economic data that the main thing about them is they're not necessarily right. Mm. They're only useful insofar as they're measured consistently. And when an inconsistency comes in, you need to be ready for it. So the fact that we consistently showed a deficit didn't mean there actually was a deficit, just because there was a hole that wasn't measured. So be wary of that kind of data. But of course, it does highlight another element where the South African economy has lost out and, of course, got stuffed up. And naturally, we would like to see this kind of retail trade return for the sake of the whole country. And of course, we need nonsense like these riots in Durban, these xenophobic riots needs to stop promptly, because frankly the rest of Africa is important to this country.
Absolutely, and we need that for REITs, for the economy, and for the broader sense of recovery. That first current account surplus in about 18 years was obviously very supportive for the rand. One worries about how sustainable that is, and ultimately what forces that might exert on the rand in the year ahead. But I want to move, Raymond, to a comment that you picked up during the week around the ratings agencies, and S&P in particular. There was a headline around S&P being lukewarm on South Africa's debt targets. Why do the credit rating agencies appear to be a little bit more negative about South Africa's fiscal situation and in their reaction to the recent budget than most local economists? There seems to be a divergence happening here.
Well, Michael, I think whether we like them or not, these credit rating agencies do play an important role today in financial markets and in perceptions about economies. Do they make mistakes? Yes. But we won't know that until later. As with all economists, you make forecasts, you're only caught out a year or two later, by which time everyone has forgotten. But nonetheless, I think we've got to understand that there can be differences of opinion. After all, economics is not an exact. There is room for a legitimate difference of opinion from setups that are really very acquainted with international experience and bring their thoughts to bear. And it may or may not always align with what some of the domestic analysts are saying. But I think what's important to understand why there may be differences of opinion is, like all of us, I think that the credit rating agencies not only have to make the most probable forecasts that they can, given the research they've done, but also how highly they rate their best forecast actually turning out to be quite wrong. And I think that the increased negativity that you get from some of the agencies is really stems from the climate of uncertainty, on which you can put more than one interpretation as to how successful we're going to be over time in reducing that level of uncertainty by doing the right things, and above all, as we've entered, implementing them in a visible and a tangible way. So I think what's important here is that we should say to ourselves, yes, let's hear what they've got to say. They have a valuable input. And I also think that we must understand that there is room for different judgment calls looking at the same data. Where I might disagree with them is, I would have thought it would be very strange in the middle of a worldwide pandemic and of the COVID-19 to impose a downward rating on any country. It just seems to me it's such an abnormal circumstance that I would have said, well, look, I think we'd better suspend our analysis for the moment and not arrive at any definitive conclusion. It's rather, I use the analogy, it's rather as if an inebriated person has fallen by accident into an icy pond, and you say, I'm not going to help you because previously you were overheated. I really don't think that is the right way. So on that judgment, I would differ. I would say the past year, one would have said, just stand still until there's more clarity, because some countries will handle the pandemic better than others. You won't know until you've had more empirical evidence of how they've dealt with uncharted waters, not only for the countries concerned, but also for the credit rating agencies.
But on that point, Raymond, I think a point well made, but I would point out that a lot of our recovery still hinges on the vaccine rollout program. And per my introduction, at current rates, we're looking at herd immunity in 10 years. You read Johnny Steinberg in the Business Day today, And I've got to quote him here. The government has broken its contract with its people in a profound and fundamental way. If this were a country in which accountability was baked into governance, Ramaphosa would have been forced to institute an independent inquiry over the handling of our vaccination program, which is stuttering and bumbling along. And I think that's potentially why the ratings agencies are looking at all of these forecasts and the models and saying, well, it really doesn't matter a jot if you're going to be facing a third, fourth, fifth, maybe even a sixth or seventh wave. And we certainly are, according to the insurance firms, Sanlam out yesterday, expecting another 2.5 waves. So on that point, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Warwick Lucas, chief investment officer at Galileo Asset Managers, with the gross domestic problems this week.